Dave Max Cork History Matters, brought to you by Red FM.
Ros Crowley, we're going to talk about an element of Cork history. In this case, the first Irish rock festival in Macroom in 1977, the Mountain Dew Festival, ran for 7 years. You've written the book on it, and I spotted you on TV over Christmas, and I said, I must get on to this lady now and find out a little more about it. How are you?
I'm very well, and fair dues to you. You're the first person to contact me after the documentary.
How Ireland Rocked the 70s, Brian Redden, Jarrod Films, and it told the story of, I suppose, the you know, because the 60s was about the show bands, really, in Ireland. And they lingered into the 70s, but 70s was when sort of a nascent rock and roll scene took off to some degree in Ireland. And there was a few false starts, like Richmond Park, the home of St. Patrick's Athletic Festival in 1970, that happened with Mungo Jerry. What was his big hit at the time?
In the Summertime.
In the Summertime, there you go. Yeah. But it didn't work. I think they'd only 1,500 people and they wanted about 5,000. So ultimately, really, the first rock and roll festival that happened in Ireland happened in Cork. And you've written the book about it. So where did you come to it? You published the book as well. So
I did. And that was how I was approached, actually, was to publish a book about the Macroom Mountain Dew Festival. I got the bare bones of the book. And I said, you know, I really think it needs to be fleshed out. Two members of the Macroom committee came to me. And I said, you know, it's not really ready for publication in its present state. I thought it needed a lot of texture, interviews with people about their reminiscences and so on. And they said, well, yeah, that sounds like a really good idea, you know, because actually, you know, a book needs quite a lot of words to have a bit of a hold, you know, in your hand. And there was a lot of information there, but there wasn't quite enough texture.
So what was there to begin with?
Yeah, there was the skeleton. There were sort of facts and figures, really.
Yes. Was that you that had put that together?
Somebody else had. Yeah. So they came to me and said, well, what do you think we can do with this? You know, because I was a Cork publisher and they liked, to be fair, to keep it Cork. So I said, well, I'll have a look at it first of all. And I did have a look at it. And I said, I thought it just needed, you know, the kind of texture of interviews with people who were there, the musicians and so on. So they said, well, can you find somebody to do that? And I said, I can. And I know a team of writers. But of course, when I started to look at it, I thought, golly, like, this is for me. I'm not handing this over to anybody else, because I come from a musical family. Mm. And my brother Peter had a band called The Axels. And Rory Gallagher used to kind of guest with him the odd time, or if he was there listening to him, to the band, he'd join in. Mm. So, and Peter and Rory were good friends. And so they're kind of really intense kind of musicians, you know, the way Rory was. And my brother was the same in a different way. He loved the kind of Latin music, and they'd have discussions about that kind of thing and where the chords came from and so on. So it was kind of really appealed to me. And I, you know, the band used to practice in our house at home, you know, so I really grew up wanting to be in the band, you know, but I was about 11 and it wasn't possible. I ended up knitting ties for them and knitting a tie for Rory Gallagher. That was the closest that I got to a connection. And then as I grew up, I was sort of allowed to go the odd time to see the Axels because my brother was playing in it and, you know, he'd bring me home. And I have another brother, Nick, who also has ended up being a professional musician as well as doing some acting in London. So, you know, it was just kind of there all the time. I mean, I just...
What venues would you go to see the Axels play? That'll bring you in.
That's a good question now, because there was a club, I think it was like St. Francis Hall, but I wasn't allowed to go there, actually. Yeah, yeah. I really wasn't. I'll tell you what they used to do is, as Rory became popular, I think maybe the Axels played ahead of Rory's band, you know, as an opening band in the City Hall. There was a famous one then. My brother then was in another band called the Modernaires, which sounds really awful, but they were a good band. They used to, actually, the Axels and various bands that he was in, they did very good cover versions of the Beatles songs. And you know, it wasn't done that much really, you know, because the other sort of competition to groups like there, as they were called, groups, and then you had the show bands, and they did a much more country and western kind of thing that we, you know, didn't really like.
Because I had it that show bands covered the pop music of the day. But you're saying it had, was there a mix of that, but it was kind of a bit more on the country and western sort of thing?
Country and western and ballad. You know, I don't think they did much. They might have done a Beatles song, you know, on a set, but I didn't.
No, that was the impression I had about the show bands. Bands didn't travel to Ireland, so Irish bands would play the popular songs of the day.
Well, they probably did. So I wasn't that interested in them at that stage because I was a groupie group, So, but they, I'm sure they did, you know, and they would have done.
So if you're into groups, you were a groupie. I mean, obviously the term groupie has a different sort of connotation, but maybe initially if you were not into show bands and you were into groups, you were a groupie. Okay.
Maybe. Well, there's a thought. I had put that thought together, but anyway.
You might have coined that in this conversation. No, but I hear what you're saying. There's a little bit of a divide there on that, and they were doing something they were a little bit more alternative, and that's what
they
the rock and roll
they were there. And you know, the show bands dressed very formally and the bands were much more beaty. They sort of like, I know the Axl Down, for example, had a jerkin, a kind of a navy jerkin that was probably fake leather, and they had these narrow ties that I knitted and white shirts, but that was sort of nearly alternative to the bigger suits and the white suits. And
it kind of made that clear in that documentary. It did sort of distill the difference. And then about how the show bands started to introduce a little bit of that coolness as I suppose as it penetrated further into the market, and they probably wanted to throw off the shackles a little bit. So it was the more formal, straight-laced side of things, even though probably to a whole section of society, the show bands themselves were the devil's work. But to the cooler end of things, they weren't cool enough or alternative enough or edgy enough.
No, and you know, you asked a good question about where the Axels played, and I, as I say, I hardly remember.
All right, I was just thinking, could it be the Arcadia or places like that?
Yes, they did. The Arcadia, you're reminding me. And then the show bands then would have been playing in the Majorca. You know, in Crosshaven, that was bigger venues, really bigger dance venues. You know, I suppose maybe some of the bands were, or the groups were for listening to rather than big dancing to, big formal dancing to, you know, and the sort of, I suppose, there was rock and roll everywhere at that time. But I think the sort of Beatles influence was more of a kind of a standing and shaking kind of dance, really, wasn't it?
I don't know. But where are we? Where are we, early to mid 70s here? I mean, it's like, again, that documentary sort of made it clear about how this scene sort of developed rather slowly, and it wasn't necessarily hugely allowed by official Ireland, let's say. I mean, what was I looking at? Reeling in the Ears last night, in 1978 was RTE2. I think it was arguably the same year that Radio 2 came about, where pop music was played on the national airwaves. Prior to that, you couldn't hear it anywhere except with the pirates. Like the youth of Ireland had to develop their own space, and it wasn't opened up for them necessarily.
No, and you know, a point that a few people made to me about in the book was that Rory Gallagher wasn't played much on RTE at all. It took a long time for him to be played. And isn't that peculiar? You know, when you consider that there was an essence of great talent there.
Well, when you think of how conservative Ireland was back then, maybe not. I mean, this was an edgier, he was a rock and roll guy with the axe guitar, and he was, you know, he was Ireland's first great rock hero, no question about it.
He was, and blues, you know, that sense of the blues, you know.
And he was the first to play. He was what. So let's get to the McCroom story. You know, Ireland's first rock festival happened in Cork, happened for 7 years. It's arguably an unusual location for it, a village of 3,000 people. Who were the people that dreamt it up, and why did they dream it up based on the... Oh, so because we've established your bona fides as a sort of a, you know, you're a musical family and a musical person. And as you were given this manuscript to potentially publish about it in the run-up to the 40th anniversary of the festival, you kind of looked at it and thought, it needs more. And then you thought, I'm the one to give it the more. So where did you go then with that?
They didn't, you know, the committee didn't take much persuasion, really. They said, off with you.
Oh, I'm sure they were delighted.
Yeah.
We have someone who knows what she's doing.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope that's what they thought. You know, I think they were a risk taker kind of gang. And they thought, you know, let her off and see what comes back. You know, I was going to have to show them the script, you know, before.
Well, come here, they must be a risk taking gang.
Well, they were.
And I mean, what to start the thing in the first place?
Exactly. I mean, what I admire about them is that, you know, Macroom, Ireland is on its heels. Okay, it was the year of that Concorde was launched, but it was also the year of the third bank strike in Ireland. Mm. You know, things were very, very tough.
Again, reeling in the years, 6 month bank strike, people watching. It's hard to even credit what that means. Well, what it means is you couldn't get cash.
You couldn't
get cash.
So
people were using coupons in I don't know, it's hard to even fathom. It really is. And it's kind of why it's interesting to do this chat too, because I hope there'll be people who will listen to our conversation and try to reflect on a very different time and about how, you know, the electric picnics of today, you know, this is the roots of it. And it wasn't easily done.
No, it wasn't. And, you know, I mean, on the plus side, I think people spent on tick that they mightn't ever have spend it all, you know. I know I bought a painting, you know, and I went to an exhibition. I just loved this thing, and I just said, I haven't got any money, but I'll have it sometime. And they said, oh, no, I'm gonna put it aside for you, you know. I mean, what was I doing, you know, because I didn't have any money really, but I knew I could have it sometime, so I did that. And so the committee, you know, Macroom was as bad as anywhere else, you know, business wise, if not a bit worse. They only had a population of 3,000, you know, to feed their village, if you like, and people were going through the village. They were they were stopping, you know, for an ice cream, you know, and moving on to Kerry. And they said, what can we do to keep them in the town? So they went through, you know, baby competitions and flower festivals and all sorts of things. But the committee had some experience of bringing in musical artists to the bars, the pubs around the place. So, and also for events and fundraising events for maybe the GAA or social clubs. So they weren't completely new to the business of booking acts. So they decided on this idea. So they said, right, what do we have to do? We have to get numbers in. So they, again, took a risk of getting the dome from the Tralee, you know, the Rose of Tralee Festival, stuck that on a site in the village. They said, now we've got to fill it, you know. So it had a capacity of about 3,000. So they had local bands on the bill. They had then they hit on the idea of getting Marianne Faithfull. And when they put her on the bill, there was an interest was created. People still didn't necessarily book tickets for it, but they did turn up on the night. So you can imagine how tough now that was for the committee, holding their breaths, you know. But huge numbers came. I mean, they easily filled, put 3,000 through the dome. And you know, there's talk of so many people coming in, they were kind of going out one door and coming in another, you know. And it was a huge success. So they actually made money from that particular one. So they were greatly encouraged to think. But they accepted then at that moment that they really needed to have a big name to get people in, that it wasn't enough to have the band from down the road, great as, you know, as support and everything, but not to bring the big numbers in from Cork, particularly because they needed more people than their population. So, well, when they thought of Rory Gallagher, of course, that was an inspired choice.
Let me just check with you, Roz, right? So Marianne Faithfull, I mean, there's a story of, so the next big rock gig was Dalymount Park with Thin Lizzy. And seemingly it was the night after, it was August, I think, of the same year that Mountain Dew's first festival occurred. Could be
76, or was it the next year? I'm not sure.
Yeah, 78. Yeah, 78. But anyway, yeah. I think it was his 28th birthday the night before the Dalymount gig, and they went, they were boozing it up in town, and then they went out to like one of the Guinness family's house in Kildare, and there was like the cops raided it, And they threw all their stash into the fire and then made their way back and did the gig the next day. But Marianne Faithfull was hanging around with Mick Jagger. She'd stayed in that Guinness. So she was around Ireland at that time. So that wasn't the first Mountain Dew Festival, was it?
That was the first one. Marianne's
so
year.
Gallagher was not the first one. He was just the one that kicked it into a bigger sort of...
He was. And it was the first one to go outside.
Gotcha. So what was that 76 then? Was Marianne Faithfull in the Dome, 3,000 exactly. people? And they kind of went, you know what? That worked well. How do we go bigger?
Exactly. Well, I'll tell you, they did. Because, well, they first of all, when they thought of Rory Gallagher, they said, well, how can we fit all his fans? I think it was probably more that.
So that's interesting to ask, actually, because the story in the documentary, which maybe I'm cutting across and I should leave you, just give it to me, but was that they got to him through his mother. But did they have him or the venue first? Was it, we got Gallagher, now we need to go bigger, or we're going to go bigger and we need Gallagher? Who knows?
Well, I can tell you, because as I said in the documentary, it was Rory was, or maybe it wasn't said enough, is that Rory was very particular about quality of sound and how he sounded and how he wouldn't disappoint fans. So when they contacted him, they thought, well, you know, it's going to bring 10,000 people into Macroom. Like, where are we going to put them? It's not, the Dome isn't going to be big enough. Gotcha. So Donal and Rory's mother was contacted, first of all, to persuade him at all, you know, to consider it.
Yeah.
So we kind of, Rory was hardly in on the conversation at this point. It was Donal really trying to make it possible, you know, and make it work. And you know, they were very fond of their mother, obviously, and they wanted to please her, and they didn't want to annoy her by not doing it. So when Donal met with the committee and looked at the castle grounds, they saw, well, actually, you know, this is not a bad shape. You know, I mean, it wasn't a full amphitheatre, but kind of half of a one, really, a big slope, and not a bad shape at all. And you could see that there was an area where you could put, a stage and so on. So it sort of started to evolve. And, you know, Rory's brother Donal is a creative person, you know, no doubt about it. I mean, he has kept the legacy going, and he's got something, you know, he really has something that is quite, creative, I think is the word. So we're doing one thing and another. Well, the next problem then is quality of sound, right? So Rory had been involved in a number of concerts in the UK, and there was a terrific sound machine over there, if you like, a Britannia company that did a lot of, you know, the big named concerts, outdoor concerts in England. So they agreed to do it. So that meant, I think that satisfied Rory then, you know, that it would be done properly, that the quality of sound would be good, and that all he'd have to do is go on and play, you know.
Yes.
And they did set it up. And I mean, like, it was said to be, it had the highest decibels of sound in Ireland up to that point. They said that from, I think, 15 miles circumference.
Here is in Kerry!
And you know, like, there was no complaints about noise pollution that concert, and it was clear. I mean, it was very interesting to hear, you know, how much people were thrilled with that. You know,
in a way, I'm surprised the authorities let it go ahead in the Conservative Ireland that we spoke of. And
well, do you know, I think they didn't know what hit them, you know, possibly, and I don't think there was that sort of body, you know, that was looking at stuff like that. It hadn't been created, you know,
it was too novel for anyone to realize the dangers that lay within. You mentioned Donal, and I look forward to doing a bit of a chat with him to gather some of his reminiscences in the future on one of these Cork History Battered podcasts, because it's an interesting part of Cork's history.
It is, and he has a lot to say, you know.
Because I think, as you mentioned there, it was, and in that documentary, How Ireland Rocked the 70s, he spoke about how his mom kept badgering him, saying, listen, this crowd keep bringing me from a groom. And he went up more to placate them more than anything else, and had the wander round, but on the wander round kind of thought, actually, this might work.
Exactly.
And it sort of rolled on from there. But he also, I think, told a story of of calling down to the Garda superintendent and having dinner in his house. And yeah. by chance, the TV was on and it showed the Isle of Wight Rock Festival. And in the Isle of Wight Rock Festival, they're all walking around with big reefers and all doing whatever. And the and seeing your man's stuffing the bit of beef into his mouth. And he kind of goes, hang on a second. It's not going to be like that, is it? He goes, oh, no, that's a jazz festival. Yeah. This is a rock festival.
Quick off the mark.
We're a far more sophisticated crowd than those jazz oikes. That's brilliant. Yeah,
exactly.
Oh, no, it was Montrose. Sorry.
It was Montrose. Exactly. Yeah. It was. And I mean, and then, you know, even that sort of exposure, if you like, of the story of how they got all the authorities involved, because they knew, you know, that numbers were could have caused trouble. Mm. But, you know, you kind of, if you look at Rory's fans, and still today, there are loads of them, and they're interested in his music. And because was the first and second, the first outdoor, and he came back for the second one, the second outdoor one, it didn't sort of develop into that drink fest that you find, you know, in festivals these days. You know, maybe half the people go for the drink. I don't know, you know, in relation to the I don't know the balances with that and the music, but for the Macroom Festival, for the first and second one, I would wager that they were there for the music.
It was quite dedicated hardcore music fans. Let me ask you about the name Mountain Dew. I mean, it fits Macroom. You're up on the mountains more or less. Yeah. They're certainly around. But it kind of played on like the local poutine, did it? Or the
it did, machine. Exactly. That's right. And it was catchy. You know, I mean, if you know, again, you come back to this Bright Committee. I mean, see, if you think of them, they were.
Yeah, who are they? Who are the names?
They were all about, a huge number of.
You don't have to give me all of them. But like, you know, some of them.
Martin Fitzgerald was the person who came to me. I dealt a lot with O'Connell. Oh, he's in some of the, I have the book here.
Show us the book. There is Macroom Mountain Dew, yeah, author of Roz Crowley and publisher.
Thank you. There's a picture of the committee here now. And
you're nothing to Crowley's music shop, Roz, while we're at it, no?
You are?
You're nothing to Crowley's music shop, no?
I'm not, no, but I know my brother used to buy
when you mentioned the musical family, I thought, well, hang on now.
Yeah.
That's where Rory Gallagher bought his first guitar up on McCurtain Street.
No, my maiden name, for it to be
honest. Oh, there you go, sure, of course.
Is Sandquist.
Sandquist?
Sandquist, yeah.
Wow, that's an interesting name.
So, Swedish origin. Yeah, and we were all kind of a bit arty. But,
And just to mention the Gallagher there as well, just to tie him in, like he started playing music in the show bands, I think at about 14 or something.
He did the Fontana show band, I remember. He cut his teeth in show bands, you know, he'd never deny that. I'm just looking at festival committee. Pat O'Connell, that's who I was trying to think of there. Chris, Dennis Murphy, John O'Callaghan. Yeah, they were all in business, you know, in one way or another.
And it was about like getting, in today's terminology, footfall into Macroom. Get a spend exactly. going, and they got a spend going.
They did, and you know, like they went for full. Kind of hell for leather because they had two weekends bookending a week of other activities, community activities.
So it wasn't just a day-long thing?
Oh, not at all. No. It was two weekends and it was things like pig races and baby competitions and GAA matches and...
Oh, sure, it was one of those kind of like one for everyone in the audience and...
It was because they acknowledged that they needed to get Macroom people behind them.
Yes.
And get them involved. Yes. And they were wise to do that, you know, because I mean it lasted 7 years and that's pretty, you know, there's an awful lot of energy goes into 7 years of that kind of work. It is work, no doubt about it, you know. And it took a lot of their energy. So these festival members, they were only in their 20s in those days. So they had that great, you know, youthful exuberance. fans, and they enjoyed it all. You know, they did, and it was good for business. They could see
them. Were you at any of them?
The pubs? No, I wasn't actually. The odd thing is that I guess, you know, knowing Rory Gallagher, you know, reasonably well, it wasn't such a big thing, and I had been to, you know, concerts of his. So if his name came up, but I was just busy with other things at the time. I was traveling a lot, and I didn't get there.
Which is a pity now.
I wish I had. So it's all. I mean, I had to work harder for the book.
Yes. So 76. They got the Festival Dome off after, and it kind of feels almost like a bit of a, I don't know, what do you call that? Stick a brick kind of thing. It's almost like, hang on, you know, Johnny, you can get the dome, and you know, and they all sort of assembled it like this. But 76 is the dome, 3,000 people, Marian Faithful, let's go bigger. They get on to Gallagher's mom, she badgers Donal, he goes out, has a chat, Rory decides to do it. So the homegrown hero coming to play Ireland's first outdoor festival. So exactly. We mentioned the Richmond Park thing, which didn't really work, I guess.
I think it lacked, it sounded like it lacked promotion, you know, drive behind it. I thought that too from the, and I hadn't really known that, you know, until I saw the documentary myself.
That's not one I've heard of, I must say. I've heard of, like, obviously the Bohemians fans are proud of the fact that Bob Marley played at Daly Mount Park and Phil Lynott, and they've murals up there reflecting that. So the 78 gig in Dublin, I'm familiar with by lore and by legend, and also the McCrew Mountain Dew one. But that's why I wanted to get onto you, was because it was like, let's dig a little bit deeper into it. So what sort of, I mean, so 76, 77 then is the first outdoor. Gallagher does 78 as well. It runs for 7 odd years or so. But what happened then on that first or second one? Did more than 10,000 come? It ran off successfully.
Yeah, oh gosh, yeah. I mean, it's hugely successfully. I mean, there was, you know, the one person that I interviewed for the book describes the sea of denim coming down the main street, you know, jam-packed. And, you know, it was much greater. I mean, very hard to quantify. They say 20,000 came into McCroom, and that's not surprising. And they filled the place. There's one story that you would have seen in the documentary that they ran out of chips as a result. And that's just a fun size thing. But I mean, you know, there was no bottled water in those days, you know, and what people were living on was bottles of milk, crisp sandwiches, chips when they could get them, tomato sauce sandwiches probably as well. And you know, when a lot of the Cork fans, when they came from coming from Cork, a lot of them had to walk. They didn't have the money for the bus fare. And they walked 41 kilometres from Cork to McCroom. And I'd say they didn't know what hit them really. It's a long walk, you know. There weren't all of these stylish Air Nike runners or anything in those days. You know, there were rubber dollies and runners, you know. So as they came into McCroom, and the people living at the entrance to McCroom, they saw there was these poor bedraggled kids, you know, and they went in and they made batches of scones and came out with them for them, you know.
The whole thing sounds magic.
It's lovely, isn't it? And you know, I remember talking to one shopkeeper, and I said, you know, I suppose did people try to sleep in your doorway? Oh, she said they did sleep in our doorway. She said, but we didn't move them on. She said, you know, they got up, you know, they went off the next day. But there was none of this kind of, you know, heavy tactics of moving on fans. They were doing no harm, you know.
Relatively welcomed at the time.
They were, and people were very glad to see them. And, you know, again, because so many people were involved in the running of it, and a lot of them policed the, informally, but formally at the same time.
They looked after their village and they were paid to do it,
you know. I mean,
sorry for anyone McCroom in the town. Not village. Although the one thing about McCroom is, can anyone decide whether it's in West Cork or not?
I think of it.
Like, It's to the west of Cork, en route to Kerry, like, but it's not really West Cork, West Cork, is it?
No, it's not really. And I think of it as a little bit north as well, you know.
it's they kind of, on one hand, they're like, we're not West Cork, we're not North Cork, we're our own, we're a place apart.
Getting a bypass now, of course.
Getting the bypass now, they'll be fierce.
That'll be interesting to see, actually, what
it does. Because it's actually a beautiful town centre.
It is. It would be nice to see it develop. I would be delighted to be able to stop, because lots of times it has been difficult to stop. I mean, if there wasn't a Lidl or an Aldi car park, you'd really be stuck for parking, you know, and that's a few steps away from where you might want to go. Mm. But so I hope it'll thrive. And I think it may be one of those satellite towns to Cork, where people who are working in Cork, you know, will be happier to commute to, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so onwards and upwards for McCroom, we certainly hope. But it was a glorious chapter in McCroom's history, no question about it. And clearly, as you're suggesting there, the people welcomed the novelty of it. What was interesting in the documentary too, you know, while it sort of charted the growth of a music industry or a music scene in Ireland, or the troubles or the travails or the struggles that there were to establish one, or the different forms that they took, it did point out that something akin to what a rock festival ends up being existed in the Flack Yoles, and the documentary, the footage of Flack Yoles looked very much like how rock festivals can end up being, with people on the streets drinking and carousing and partying. So perhaps there was some sort of a familiarity with how it looked as a result of that.
Oh, I think so. I mean, for a start, in Ireland there's a great tradition of music anyway. And also the love of music. There's huge talent. I think it's extraordinary, you know, what talent we produce and export and, you know, have the world enjoy, but have for ourselves. And in those, I mean, to be able to go to various villages around Ireland and just walk in and enjoy live music, isn't it a treat, honestly, because there's such talent. And I love, you know, I've often gone down now to Coolay and around there, down to Ballyvourney, you know, where the cultural centre is. And I just love when people come along and somebody else joins in and, you know, say, oh yeah, I know that one, you know, and you've got like seven fiddlers, like all of a sudden, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think that's natural to us, you know. Mm-hmm. And in Cork, as I don't have to tell you, you know, it's between Shinné and the other, what's the other one in the Coburg Street? The Corner House, exactly. You know, every time I have visitors, you know, we end up there, mm-hmm. and they've always sat down not talking to people, you know, and then they're just amazed at how natural it is to everybody, you know. So I think music is in us, like, as so many other art forms are, I suppose.
So what were the stories that you dug out? I think we've got, I'm trying to think if I can remember any other of the Rory Gallagher ones, the mom and him coming up, and then the superintendent, that was a good one. And Gallagher loved it anyway. I think there was footage in the documentary, it might have been from the second year, but of him coming out on stage anyway, and the fans giving the odd comment or two, and you know, he was a huge local hero.
He really was, and you know, he, as I say, he loved his fans. I mean, like the price of the festival or that day was really set by him and Donal at £2.50. You know, that's 20 euros in today's money, you know, because he didn't want it to be priced out of anybody's reach. Can you imagine? I mean, wouldn't we be lucky now if we only had to spend 20 euro on a concert? Yeah. I felt like I've spent a lot of money going to my own heroes, you know, in Cork, you know, and it's a very expensive business these days. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, that was part of the charm and why the prices were to be kept down, is that there wasn't the sort of I think people thought of it as quite a country kind of spot, so they didn't charge huge amounts. You know, there weren't huge agents' fees and so on. Mm-hmm. You know, managers didn't for a while, mm-hmm. until towards the end they sort of said, "Well, no, I think we deserve a little bit more for the action."
As it went on over the years.
Let me
share the screen here just while we're chatting, because I have a piece that you wrote in the Examiner in 2016, presumably as you were developing the book. Can you see it there?
It was actually when it was done. I think that was, let me see, what date was that? Monday, July. Yeah, the June it was launched.
Monday, 11th of July. Yeah. 2016 is this piece.
Yeah. So that was about a month after the book was launched.
Oh, right. Okay. Because sorry, I thought it was for the, because 76 was the first one.
Yeah.
So I have 77 as the date in my mind of this, because that was the first, that was the date that Gallagher played. But as we've established, either one was Marian Faithful in the Dome. So 76 was the 40th anniversary of it. And the book was released to commemorate that. So you can see the screen, Roz, can you?
I can.
Great.
And I stand by every word.
Well, there we can see Gallagher, and there's some fine haircuts, and look at how
kind of hair.
Actually, I think there's footage in the documentary as well of him arriving in like, is it a Ford Cortina or something? Or that's actually, there it is. There's the corner of the car. There he's just getting out of it.
Yeah, no, I'll tell you what it was now. It was a bit more extravagant than that. Ford Cortina.
Was it what else was SNL? No, what else were flat? Was it not a Mustang or something like that? Ford Escort. Maybe. Well, I'm going to go Ford just with the whole Cork thing, because that would keep it Cork, wouldn't it?
How do you mean?
Well, the Ford factory. I mean, maybe it had closed by then, but I associate Ford cars with Cork for all those reasons.
Yeah. Oh, sure. It kept an awful lot of people going for a long time.
Yeah. But that was actually around the time where it had probably gone, it and Dunlop's. And that was a major blow, really, for Cork economically.
It was. Yeah.
But look at, while you dig away, you keep looking, because I'm going to scroll down here.
Because I did write it. I know, but it's just gone out of my head.
And what I want, there it is. There's the Marianne Faithful stuff, yeah. And there you go. There's some of the others that played: Gallagher, Morrison, Elvis Costello, Paul Young, Paul Brady. A 10-day festival with bands playing indoors during the week, with a wide range of fun events, talent competitions, and sports events. And she's looking for Morrison.
I know. Oh, you know, he had a terrible accident actually on the day, which I think I referred to. He knocked his crown off. He went into a piece of construction of the stage and knocked his tooth off, and he had to go off stage and put it back in. It was found.
That picture actually looks like the moment it happened.
He's
certainly got a grimace going on. Oh, my bloody tooth!
It was not his happiest of concerts, but you know. Said this is not unusual. You know,
by reputation, I think there's a few of those. Magella Elliott, like, I mean, there's some fabulous little anecdotes that you have here. We won't go through them all, because I would encourage, actually, look, where do we have the book? There is the book again. That's how it looks. Roz Crowley, foreword by John Martin Fitzgerald, McCroom Mountain Dew. I presume it's still available to be purchased.
Yeah, it's online, but it's also in Waterstones, and it's in that lovely place, the architects, the Nanonagle Centre.
Oh, very good. Oh, yeah. Suitably enough.
Yeah. Super spot.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, like, I'm reading this and kind of being like, oh, that's what you were telling me about the people arriving, having walked and hitched from Cork, and good relationship with the Gardaí, his festival director, John Martin Fitzgerald.
Idi
Amin story. So he was a brutal Ugandan dictator. Was he known to be brutal at that time?
Yes, he was.
So to attract a bit of attention, they invited him, because was it the UK were refusing to have him come over or something?
It was. Yeah, there was. Actually, I mean, you know, who would have had him really? You know,
ball hopping in proper Cork style.
This was ball hopping, and. The committee was shameless and said, all right, let's try this and see what happens, you know, throw a bit of mud at it and see what'll stick.
What's the Mike Murphy one?
Pardon me?
Sorry, go on. Sorry, apologies.
But they sent the invitation. He didn't drive, imagine.
Funnily enough.
But, you know, if you look there now, I'm just looking at Mike Murphy there. He was great fun. And
because you mentioned Concord, he was on, I don't know, one of the first ones anyway. I saw that reeling in the ears too.
Is that right? I didn't know that.
So from sipping champagne and canapes on the first Concord to Mountain Dew Festival there in McCroom, looking well. He's a good man. He seems like a really good sort. Mike Murphy?
Yeah, oh, great sort. And we had a lovely chat. And, you know, he was, I think he was in Florida or something when I rang him. And he was quite happy to have a good chat. And he enjoyed it. You see, and he remembered what went on. One of my huge problems with writing the book was people's fading memories. My memory. Because I mean, 40 years ago, what I was trying to do was divide it up between the years so that I could be clear who played what and what the reaction was.
Yes.
But, you know, like there were people who said to me, well, you know, Van Morrison was on the stage with Rory Gallagher. No, he wasn't. You know, it just didn't happen. It was 6 years apart.
And then they're like, you weren't even there.
No.
And we're like, listen, I've done the research, okay? You were there. You just don't remember. You were, you know, you were emotional at the time.
Oh, golly. So, but I mean, you know, do you think 40 years ago, if you're even 40, you know, there's not a whole lot
In fairness.
That would come to you. And also because, you know, they're all pleasant experiences. You know, they all melded into one happy you know, like a dream, you know.
And I've been to a fair few electric picnics, and you're right. I mean, I couldn't tell you which one was which or...
I think one of the things that was so marvelous, really, it was about, particularly in contrast to concerts I've been into in recent times, is that they got physically close to their heroes, you know. I mean, the stage wasn't, you know, I went to a gig now a couple of years ago, and I could, you know, I could barely tell what people were wearing. I was so far away because I wasn't allowed to be closer, you know. And in Macroom, it was very easy for them to be close.
So I guess this Mike, sorry, Roz, I keep cutting across you. My apologies.
Not at all. If I...
No, I keep cutting across you, and I'm apologetic for that because you're in the course of telling me something, and I'm looking at something else and jumping onto it. But essentially, basically, people were able to get, you know, there was an openness and an access that there isn't anymore, really.
Exactly, and another thing that the committee made sure of also is that there was a festival club, and anybody could go to it. You know, there wasn't a cordoned off spot, you know, for the stars. You could go if you wanted to, you know. And I that's nice if you can get away with it, you know. I mean, you know, these days everything is kind of bigger and it's more policed and everything. It's all a bit sanitized, isn't it? You know, I find that anyway.
Then I grew up so I'm from Dundalk originally, and I grew up with a friend from out in Ravensdale, north of Dundalk, in the start of the Cooley Peninsula. It's the Gap of the North is where Ravensdale is on route to Newry. And my friend was Thomas Cunningham, and he was of the Lennox Cunninghams. And they turned out to be cousins of Henry Mountcharles. I only kind of know this now looking back, but at a tender age, that's how I ended up at Slane in 87 for Queen. Or was it 87 for Queen and 88 for Bowie? And I remember sights and sounds from then, and it was wild. So I agree with you on the sanitized, and it's overly officiated, let's say, because of health and safety and insurance. At the same time, some of what I saw back then, you're like, it's probably good that they've controlled things a little bit more. There were some crazy scenes.
Yeah, well, you know, the exception, you know, as I think in defense of today, I went to see John Grant recently up in St. Luke's. And I thought, you know, this is actually what I want to be, you know, how I want to see my musicians, you know, because you are close. You're not at any kind of remove at all. I mean, it was COVID, you know, it's only about 6 weeks ago, I think. And we were all wearing our masks and everything. But, you know, he was close enough for me to almost see his eye colour, you know. And I think that's great. That's what I want. You know, when I go to see somebody, I don't want to be a whole playing field away from and looking at something on the screen. You know, it's a compensation, but it's not as... you know, as I would wish it. And I think, you know, Macroom got away with that, you know, for the years that they did it.
I stopped sharing the screen because I briefly had that moment of panic that I'm sure everybody does when they're, you know, recording a chat on Zoom where they're like, am I actually recording this?
I know.
Because this is a great convo and I would be aghast if it ended up. It's happened to me before. I did a whole chat with Gavin James and both of us thought the other was recording. And I finished the whole thing and I was talking to the manager and I was like, so will you send me the, and he was like, what do you mean? And I was like, so anyway.
Oh, no.
Yeah, anyway. Anyway, we are recording, so that's great. People will be able to watch this if they wish. And if they've delved this deep, well, well done to you. But it's a good Cork story and that's why it's a Cork History Matters podcast. We can recognise, I think, the main square in Macroom there. There's the Perks truck advertising its wares down Yall, presumably. Yeah. And I guess the Mike Murphy on the main on the stage in the town reflects the kind of the nature of it. It wasn't a one-day festival. It was a week long with a variety of events because it looks like there's scouts in front of them.
Yes, so, yes, and there were
band members.
Oh, there were lots of parades of scouts and sports people going through the city.
So it was like a gala.
The what? Yeah.
It was like a gala. Let's just, what do we have? Let everybody out. There's shine up the brass buttons, put on the hat, get out and have a march around and put a smile on. And because I see probably some sort of trad session maybe going on the stage, or at least there's a few,
there was a lot of Irish dancing and you know, people like Padraig O'Riordan. I mean, the Irish contingent was by no means ignored, you know, I mean, between Clonard and Horselips and Paul Brady and a terrific range of acts, you know, of artists and the Bothy Band and Phil Lynott, of course, and Rocky De Valera and Freddie White, who is still going strong. And he's getting better and better, I think. But the Oria there, you know, there was a mass, you know, one of the Oria, the masses was performed as it often is now at funerals. But so that element wasn't forgotten by any means. So, you know, when you're talking about rock concert, I guess it was a bit broader in the long term than that. It was a music festival.
Well, that might have been, and just on a slight aside, a lovely documentary by the granddaughter of Padraig O'Riordan on T.G. Cahir over Christmas too, which was very interesting.
It was.
But that flavour feels very Irish, but it might have fed into Liz Dunvarna then, which had a similar mix, and Christy Moore was reflecting on how that was what was so great about it, and that it sort of it kept that and actually, like, I was at one of the Trip to Tips as well, and it sort of had a sort of a wide variety of styles of acts.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember Nancy Griffith and her Blue Moon Orchestra were there and you know, there were all sorts, really. And I think that's probably a good thing. So Mike is doing his comparing thing, which is something I like to do myself. It's always fun to be out on stage and be directing people and pointing them around. And here's this and here's people who can do things. Out you go and do something. but we'll just scan down maybe just to conclude, Roz, and thanks for your time.
Not at all. Pleasure.
I mean, the Johnny Rotten. He was being presented with a Hot Press Award.
He was.
And he was put on a plane to Ireland. It wouldn't take the seats that he was meant to be in beside the organizer, whoever, sat between two nuns and revealed to them, even though the start of that sentence sounds very wrong, but actually the end of the sentence is pretty wrong too, that he was wearing a priest's uniform underneath.
Yeah.
Because Johnny Rotten likes to be provocative.
That's what he does.
That's what punk is.
I was in Reykjavik when he opened a punk museum in a set of lavatories, public lavatories, and he was on the plane coming home, and he was just scanning the waiting room like for somebody who'd give him attention, you know. Nobody was taking any notice of him, and I mean, I knew him of old, of course, and I had a quick look at that museum, you know, which is it's hard to call public lavatories a museum, but that's what it is. In Reykjavik, and he had opened it, and that's why he was there. So I mean, he does, that's what he does, you know. Anyway, you know, he seems to have made a life for himself with that kind of activity. But, you know, it was for the committee, it was frustrating that kind of attention would be given and taken off the real value, you know, of musicians who, you know,
Yeah, and even the sort of thing that could cause people to go, hang on a second, what's going on here, and who are these lads, and how do we shut them down? Because, you know, that could the Cimarrons, we'll leave people to find out that story for themselves, but it involves the sorts of stereotypical things that people might associate with a reggae band from Jamaica, and what they might be smoking on the way over.
The Cimarrons were the funniest people ever to interview, because I tried to get them all together and just get them to bounce off each other, you know, and we were doing it on, like, I think WhatsApp. I don't think there was even Zoom at that 5 years ago. Four years ago. But they all used to meet on a Saturday night. And because they don't play a lot nowadays, you know, it is 40 years later. And I had to come home from something to be there, you know, to be at home to record them. And they were hopping around. They were still wearing the big hats, the big knitted hats over the dreadlocks and everything. Oh, they were really great fun and so nice, you know, very kind and fun. And they, you know, they were going on about how lovely it was in Macroom and the warm feeling they had and everything. And, you know, and they had brought in some their stash, you know. And oh, I mean, you know, it was so normal to them, you know, to have a few spiffs, you know, and it wasn't hard drugs, you know. I say. So
it's just we live in such a world of cancel culture that I think we'll there's plenty we could say. But I love the fact that they did actually get stopped by a plainclothes officer, who I'm not sure whose story this is. This could be Donald Gallagher's story, I think. Did he end up carrying on as part organizer? Is this just a quote from the book from you?
I think that was the Cimarrons themselves, actually.
Yes.
Yeah, because I remember because they were stopped because somebody had come up to them and said, would you like this? You know, would you like this? And
with a big spliff.
A little spliff. And he said, that's nice. He said, no, there you are. Now there's a bit of Kerry gold for you, you know.
I grew it myself. I call it Kerry gold. Mad. Brendan Grace is in there, and he had a wiry. And it is amazing as well when you go through the history of stuff in Ireland and you discover who was where and what they were doing before they later became what they became or whatever. Yeah. The road that they took themselves. So Brendan Grace recently departed. His assistant roadie was a funny little wiry young fella by the name of.
Exactly, of Brendan O'Carroll.
Brendan O'Carroll, Mrs. Yeah. Brown's boys.
Exactly, it was that funny, you know. Johnny Lappin now, I was listening to on the documentary as well. And he was the roadie for a guy who played the violin, the kind of jazz violin, Joe O'Donnell. And that was his job at the time, and he has a story in the book about turning up and only half the equipment had arrived ahead of him, and he had to follow it up. Let's say that was his job, but it is quite interesting actually to see where they are now, and you know, because I did try to do that with a lot of the bands, you know, what were they up to, and a lot of them are doing much the same. Like for example, Rory Gallagher's guitarist Jerry McAvoy has a kind of, he doesn't like to call it a tribute band, but a band that plays Rory Gallagher's music and others, and they, a lot of them at the time, they go up to Ballyshannon, you know, where there's a Rory Gallagher festival every year. So a lot of them are keeping on going, you know, with their music, which I'm glad to see. Because a lot of them are super talented. I mean, you know, Maddie Pryor in Lindisfarne is still going strong. You know, that was the name kind of back sort of to, I suppose, probably the 60s maybe. And I'm still in touch with Jenny Han, actually. She had a band called Lion. And we're just in touch on Facebook. She's a grandmother now. And there she was in this, you see her in the book. She's in this white outfit with a big circle cut out of her front, exposing her navel, imagine. She's lovely, you know. And a few people I've kept in contact.
Well, I guess anyone who was 20 is now 60. and anyone who was 30 is now 70. Yeah. And anyone who is 35 to 40 is I think people can do the math on that. I guess it does. But the fact about it is that it was Ireland's first rock festival, and it paved the way for all the rest to come, and it could only have happened in Cork, which is beautiful. And your book documents it all, and this conversation was an effort at doing that too. We'll maybe just finish, Roz, with that last little bit there that people have probably read, because I've had the screen shared for so long, so anybody could have read all these bits. Never mind me being coy about the Cimarron story, they could read it right in front of them. Niall Stokes, who, and I think Hot Press began in 78, so it really was sort of the beginning of a lot. Of a lot. And Slane then began just on into the 80s, because actually, again, the documentary, How Ireland Rocked Through the 70s, was it? Hang on, yeah. How Ireland Rocked the 70s, obviously finished before the 80s, but it did have one story of the Rats, the Boomtown Rats. So obviously, you'd Rory Gallagher as Ireland's first rock hero. Then you'd Thin Lizzy, you'd the Rats. I guess you'd Van Morrison up north as well. So they were the big Irish names, really. Mm. But the Rats
and
were...
the Undertones.
The Undertones, of course, yes. Yeah. Teenage Kicks. But the Rats were coming back, and they were to do a gig in Dublin, and it got pulled on them, or they weren't allowed to do it. And then they refused to leave because, you know, Geldof saw the opportunity to turn it into a bit of a sort of a publicity sort of, or, you know, he standing sticking by his principles. But they ended up doing a gig, possibly in the aforementioned Guinness place in Kildare. So like Lord Ivey or someone.
Yes, he rescued the situation. That's right. I heard that on the documentary, that he came in and said, well, right, you can't play there, play here.
Yes, but that could have influenced
something else.
But, you know, you'd wonder if we were ever to get the chance to chat to him, Henry Mancharles might be like, I was at that gig and that's where I thought, you know what, I've got a field that is a natural amphitheatre framed by the River Boyne in Slane. Why don't I bring a few acts to there? And boy, did he.
Yeah,
I think Lizzie began that one. Amazing. And then it was, you know, Bruce Springsteen, David Bowie, Queen, Madonna, Bon Jovi, Guns N' Roses, any number of massive acts have played in that. And we hope it comes back again.
Exactly. I mean, and many more. I mean, there must, I don't know, I suppose spaces are becoming smaller, really, with massive building and development.
Well, also, I kind of think like the acts that can fill those sorts of places, I mean, it's hard to see. It will be interesting to see in 30 years' time who will be the stadium acts. I mean, will they be holograms of the role? I saw the Rolling Stones in Croke Park a number of years back, and without any meaning to be disrespectful, I kind of thought it would be a bit of a sort of a nostalgia thing. It would be like nice to see them. Oh, my God. What a full-on rock and roll band who played for I don't know how long, but like 2 hours plus. I mean, I was imitating Mick Jagger doing his kind of, he's got this hand thing that he does. I was imitating it so much that my arm started to hurt. He's 70 plus. They were, and Charlie Watts, God rest him, but like, what a full on, like a blues rock and roll band. They did a little blues section bit, which is, you know, because in a way, they sort of took the blues music, the black blues music of the States, and made it acceptable for a white audience, arguably. Certainly they blew up in Britain playing black blues music, and then brought that black blues music to a white audience in America, which was the kind of weird revolutionary thing. But they did a little blues section in the gig in Croke Park, and it was brilliant. Like, what a band.
I think Bruce Springsteen is forever going to fill a stadium, you know.
Yeah, but what I mean is in that in 30 years' time, who will be the acts that will do it? I mean,
There will be some. I think there will be.
And by the way, there's so much talent,
you know.
A lot of people might find this strange, certainly when we're talking about the likes of the Stones or Bruce Springsteen, or, you know, there's a lot of people would underestimate the likes of a Coldplay, who I also saw in Croke Park, who I might have thought, you know what, I like their songs on the radio. You know, I'm not sure if as a band there's as much depth as there might be to these other acts. But let me tell you, I've never seen a stadium bounce in the manner and the means by which Coldplay did it. Pyrotechnically, lights, they brought something to it that I've never seen before. Literally, the whole stadium bounced for the whole gig. And they actually tried to bring it down for their encore and do a little kind of tender, quiet little thing. And no one had any interest because people were like, they were just, it was, I've never seen so many fireworks. I don't know how they made a profit on the gig.
Wow.
But anyway, lots of people might be like, Coldplay, trust me. Yeah. If what I saw that day is replicated whenever anybody goes to see them, you'll see a show and a half. But yeah, I don't know. The major big stadium acts aren't as prevalent, and music has changed so much that you just wonder. I mean, is it Drake? Is it Snoop Dogg?
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I know. And by the way, I like both of those acts, but I mean, are they the stadium filling acts of the future? I time will tell.
Yeah, well, I think there'll always be talented people, you know, and I think people recognize talent. And I mean, you look at the newish talent now, like, who am I thinking of? Who's the Irish act? Very good. Irish guy on his own.
What, Niall Horan?
No.
Are we going pop or are we going...
Yeah, it's still pop. Yeah. I mean, not as poppy as Niall Horan, but...
Let me see. Oh, Dermot Kennedy.
Dermot Kennedy, exactly. You know, and people like him who write their own music. Mm. You know, I think people appreciate that.
Well, again, and Ed Sheeran as one man and a guitar. Now, obviously, he loops the guitar, but... That gig was extraordinary for one person and his guitar. He's making at the moment. I don't think he'll be able to do it on his own without a band, which will be interesting to see when he comes back to court this year. But listen, this has developed into a nice old extra ended musical chat. But it was about the Mountain Dew Festival in Macroom.
Where it all started.
A tip of the hat to all those who were involved in making it happen and making sure that Irish rock, that festivals, music festivals in Ireland, modern rock music festivals began in Cork. Where better could it have begun? And I'm grateful to you, Rose Crowley, for your chat.
A pleasure, Mike. Thank you.
Mountain Dew. Dave. Yes, Dave. There you go. That's all right. Do you know what? Look, just before we finish, let's just throw it back up for people to see. That's the book there. Macroom Mountain Dew, Memories of Ireland's First Rock Festival, Waterstones and Nanonagle.
And online here.
On Douglas Street and online. Ross Crowley, thank you so much.
Lovely.
You've been listening to a Red FM podcast. For more extra content, go to redextra.ie.